From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, defending the Iran deal, John Kasich, and more Trump uproar in the GOP, theater shooting in Lafayette, a traffic stop, and Sandra Bland. Republican Senator James Risch of Idaho brought the heat on the Iran nuclear deal to John Kerry.
With all due respect, you guys have been bamboozled.
Before he hit the border, Donald Trump sparked fury in the GOP with an attack on the heroism of Vietnam prisoner of war, John McCain.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
And the country was riveted by dash cam video of the traffic stop of Sandra Bland for not using her blinker. She ended up dead in her jail cell in Texas.
I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car!
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out!
Wow.
Now!
I will light you up. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Janelle Ross of the Washington Post, Nancy Youssef of the Daily Beast, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Your thoughts on the Iran deal, on Donald Trump, on Sandra Bland's arrest and death. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from New York is Janelle Ross, reporter for The Washington Post. She covers race, gender, immigration, inequality. Janelle Ross, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Nancy Youssef joins us, senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast, a longtime Middle East correspondent. Nancy Youssef, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
And from the studios of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Janelle.
We've got a lot to get to today. Let's go right to the Iran nuclear deal first. John Kerry and more in the hot seat yesterday. Senate interrogating them on the deal. John Kerry is saying, you want something else? You want Iran's complete capitulation? That is a fantasy.
Let me underscore. The alternative to the deal that we have reached is not some sort of unicorn arrangement involving Iran's complete capitulation. That is a fantasy.
That is a fantasy, but Republicans and more were not entirely having it, to say the least. Here was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker of Tennessee, saying the deal with Iran is a bad one.
We began 20 months or so ago with a country that was a rogue nation that had a boot on its neck. And our goal was to dismantle their program. We've ended up in a situation where the deal that's on the table basically codifies the industrialization of their nuclear program.
Nancy Youssef, Congress has 60 days to think about this. What is it down to, 56 or something like that now? What are the signals out of the questioning that we've seen on Capitol Hill about where this is likely to go when the vote comes on Capitol Hill?
Well, one of the things I think you saw, and you could even see it in that clip, is that both sides seem to be talking past one another. John Kerry and Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, and the Energy Secretary, Eric Moniz, who testified, who testified with him, wanted to talk about the specifics of the deal and how that stopped Iran's nuclear proliferation. The Republicans and some of the opponents to the deal, including some Democrats, seem to be focused on Iran's role in the region, Iran as a pariah state, Iran's relationship with the United States. And so what you saw in the back and forth was one side wanting to talk about how the deal dealt with one issue and the other side wanting to talk about the implications of that deal on all the other issues related to the U.S. and Iran.
I mean, John Kerry is saying that the number one implication, if we don't get this, is that once again making the claim that we'll probably be headed to war. He was saying that war is the option.
If this agreement isn't agreed to, it doesn't meet Congress's approval, and the sanctions are gone, and Iran goes back to enriching, you can hear the hue and cry right now. People are going to be saying, well, what are we going to do about it? They're enriching. You'll hear the Prime Minister of Israel calling you up, time to bomb.
Time to bomb. Is that fear-mongering, Nancy, or is that a reasonable warning?
A little bit of both, really, because there are so many factors that come in between that. I mean, how this could play out, it's hard to believe that it would be that simple. My guess is that any move otherwise would be a lot more furtive than that, rather than some big declaration from Iran that we've now got a nuclear weapon and we're ready to strike. But his comments in the back and forth, I think, really got at how both sides are viewing the deal and the implications of not implementing it. That the Obama administration is being very practical about about how to deal with the issue of nuclear proliferation. And you have opponents saying, but the absence of a deal, the deal itself doesn't necessarily lead to an end-all solution, that we can't trust the Iranians, that in the deal itself, that the inspectors can't just show up whenever they want, but that they're warned beforehand, and that there's a lot of wiggle room for the Iranians to both be able to potentially keep their nuclear program intact in some form, and at the same time see a relief of sanctions that in some cases have limited their ability to fund their regional proxies, like Bashar al-Assad in Syria, like the Houthis in Yemen. And so the reality is it's very much in the gray, that there will not be absolutes either one way or the other in terms of what happens if the deal goes through, what happens if the deal fails. The other thing I would say is that this is not just for the United States to deal with. There are five other nations involved, that the UN has already come out on this deal. And so Congress finds itself in this difficult position. While there's great impact that they can have potentially on the deal in this country, you have five other nations and Iran moving independently of that. And so how Congress reacts and where that fits in this framework that is not just between the U.S. and Iran, but between five major powers and Iran.
A German trade delegation already in Tehran. Janelle Ross, what's your sense of how this whole question over the nuclear deal is settling in politically, settling in with the American people?
I think that people are generally, I think, somewhat war averse. But, of course, you see some pretty strong partisan divides, and at least the way that people respond to pollsters when asked about the nuclear deal. And they tend to break right along the lines that I think you would expect in terms of what you're hearing from our elected officials.
Jack, this will come to a vote at some point. The White House seems to be counting on the fact that they will not be able to override a veto. That, of course, will depend on how many Democrats go against the White House position here and John Kerry. What do you see?
I thought he was received pretty well by the Democrats. For example, Tim Kaine of Virginia, who had preliminary doubts about this, who was one of the principals who got through the resolution allowing Congress to have a say, he seemed to be unclouded in his approval of it. On the other hand, Senator Cardin, the ranking member, said he was still ambivalent. So mixed signals there. I thought, to me, the moment in the debate that relates, I think, to the 2016 election was raised by Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, presidential candidate, who said, addressing Iran, he said, Iran needs to understand that a majority of this Congress is against this deal, and if my party wins the election, this deal is going to be annulled. And, you know, Senator Cardin said that is as close to the edge of sort of almost negotiating with a foreign power as you can get. He was alarmed by that. And, of course, what Senator Rubio is saying is that on the day a Republican candidate is elected, there would be an international crisis. The crisis would be that our allies would say, what are you doing? We're pulling out of a deal that's been going on. The crisis would be obviously with Iran. Now, Scott Walker went Rubio one better or worse on this line when he said that the first day in office, a new president could face war with Iran. So the 2016 election is shaping up as a war and peace election.
Nancy, is this annullable if it goes through? Is it as simple as the new president comes in and says, forget about it?
I don't think so, because this is not just a deal with the United States. It's a deal with six major powers. And remember that the United States, in terms of economic trade, is not nearly as invested as some of these other countries are. And so this will have a momentum of its own. And those other countries will speak up, particularly if one starts to see the effects of it, that the program has in fact been annulled, that the sanctions have been lifted in such a way that is not leading to increased funding to regional projects. There are a lot of factors that come into play that this will have a momentum of its own that is not as simple as the United States coming in and saying the U.S. is out of the deal, because it's not just between the United States and Iran. This is a deal that, even if you start it after the 90 days will have implications that are going to reshape the region. It is not as simple as the United States pulling out and everything goes back to what it was.
That's going to get hotter and hotter in the weeks ahead. We will watch it. Donald Trump trying to keep it hot all the time here. Big question, how much attention do we pay? But he's down at the border, went to Laredo in Texas. Speaking there, he said he put himself in personal danger, but he had to do it.
They say it's a great danger, but I have to do it. I love the country. There's nothing more important than what I'm doing.
Donald Trump on the border in Laredo. Didn't look too dangerous. One of the safest cities in the country, NPR News noted. But he sure threw the grenades that got the GOP worked up this week after he questioned the war heroism of Senator John McCain. Here's Rick Perry of Texas striking back.
Let no one be mistaken. Donald Trump's candidacy is a cancer on conservatism, and it must be clearly diagnosed, excised, and discarded.
Janelle Ross, how is the Republican Party responding to this one of 16 who's grabbing so much of the limelight in recent weeks?
It seems there's a good deal, as I'm sure anyone listening to Governor Perry could grasp from that quote. There's a good deal of consternation and or concern about the amount of attention that Donald Trump and his candidacy have received, but also sort of the direction in which his candidacy has really sort of shifted the whole conversation around certain issues, namely immigration and border issues. I think it certainly puts the GOP in a pretty well-documented, difficult spot in terms of some of its larger goals, in terms of expanding its base or its electorate and who might support their ultimate nominee.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, defending the Iran deal, the president off to Africa, a theater shooting in Lafayette, Louisiana, Trump on the border and more, and the traffic stop of Sandra Bland. Janelle Ross is with us from The Washington Post. Nancy Youssef from The Daily Beast. Jack Beatty's here. Can't tear ourselves away for just another second from the GOP uproar about this guy in their midst who's grabbing so much media attention. Here was Lindsey Graham. This is talking with Charlie Rose on CBS this morning on Tuesday, going after Donald Trump.
All I can say is that this is turning into a circus, and there comes a point
in time. Damaging the party.
Yeah, I don't care if he drops out. Stay in the race. Just stop being a jackass. Mm-hmm. You don't have to run for president and be the world's biggest jackass.
Callers, Jake in Somerville, Massachusetts. Jake, you are on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
So about Trump's popularity with the media, I wanted to kind of move the direction of the conversation towards the media as a whole and how horse race journalism, especially TV, emphasizing polling with a few hundred people and large margins of errors can totally shift the conversation and give Trump this meteoric rise. And I was just kind of asking, you think if the conversation was a little more serious, long-form policy-oriented, if Trump would even be able to do this, and how the kind of mainstream model of media, the horse race election model, fuels his campaign, and if that contributes to his sort of mastery of media manipulation.
I mean, this is the guy who knows the media very well. He's got a pension from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. He's got The Apprentice under his belt. So there's no question he knows how to work it. But Jack, what about this assertion that this is a media-driven rise to popularity in the polls? And it does show up in the polls, but Jake questions the whole formula here.
Yes, I think very, very ably, too. This is a point made this week by Nate Cohn, who's the poll analyst at The Times. He called it the turning point of the Trump campaign. That is the statement about John McCain, the defamation of McCain. And he says this is a classic media-driven bump. And he says Herman Cain, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, they all had them. And that is the media goes after these people the way it does a traffic accident or a bleeds story. They just can't resist. He's on all the time, and he says he's the focus of all shows. But they haven't, as our caller rightly said, got into who he is and what he stands for. And Cohn's point, he said, the turning point of the campaign, of the Trump campaign against him, is right now, because now the media is bound to get in to point out, for example, he has supported a $5 trillion tax increase. He has said, quote, that he is very pro-choice, though he's since changed that position. He's donated to Hillary Clinton. He said he likes the Clinton Foundation. He supported universal health care and even seems to do so now. In other words, he is not a conservative, and he's running in a party that is strongly conservative. If the media now starts to focus on his politics, insofar as one can say that about him, the bump is bound to come down. On the other hand, he's got this dramatic moment coming up. Because of the bump, he's going to be in the debate in a couple of weeks, the Fox debate, and is bound to just sort of dominate that one way or another. So the turning point may not have happened. It may not show up just yet. But if Cohn is right, just in the inevitable flux of the media, first they build him up, then they knock him down. Even his most dogged supporters are going to get the message, hey, this guy really isn't one of us.
But Janelle, maybe Donald Trump's showmanship is just faster than the media can chew. I mean, after all, there is a place, there is populism inevitably comes into democracy. Should we have just, five guys sitting in a room somewhere saying, no, he's a clown, pay no attention to this guy?
In fairness, certainly there are legitimate things to be said about the way that the political press approaches coverage and what does get attention and what does not. It also is worth pointing out, though, that Donald Trump is, in fact, leading in several national polls. So there is some level of interest in this man, from the actual voter. Certainly, to Mr. Beatty's point, there are a series of things that could be asked and perhaps examined more closely with regard to Donald Trump's policies and positions that might, in fact, be at odds with where some of the GOP voters would like their candidate to be. But at this particular moment, I have to agree that what we have coming is probably next a debate in which Donald Trump and his, shall we say, unique style are going to certainly grab a lot of attention. And really, it wouldn't be possible to cover the debate without taking note of a person who will likely be somewhere near the center of the stage, both literally and figuratively.
And in terms of topiary arrangements, no doubt. We've got to talk about Ash Carter in the Middle East. I want to come back to John Kasich, but I just can't wait any longer to get to Sandra Bland. It's had affected so many people this week watching this video, the dash cam video of that arrest. Didn't use a blinker for a lane change, the police officer said, and a few days later, dead in her jail cell. But even before that, just the drama of how this played out. Here we had some more. Here's some more. This is the Texas State Trooper, Brian Encinia, Sandra Bland. Sandra Bland says the officer has slammed her head on the ground after pulling her over for failing to signal a lane change. Just a piece of that dash cam video that has riveted the country.
Full traffic signal.
You are yanking around. When you pull away from me, you're resisting arrest.
This makes you feel real good, don't it? A female for a traffic signal.
I got it.
For a traffic signal. I know that makes you feel good, officer.
Okay, take care of yourself.
I know it makes you feel real good. You're a real man now. You just slammed me, knocked my head in the ground. I got epilepsy.
And the police officer then says, good. I'm not sure if he's talking about her epilepsy or the fact that she's slammed her head to the ground. But it's kind of it's just simply a shocking thing to see. This can't be the most professional policing in the country, and that's to say the very, very least. You can well understand or well imagine the dialogue in her mind after everything we've seen in policing over the last year and a half to be pulled over like this and for it to turn into a, I will light you up with a taser, more or less in her face. Janelle Ross, what is to be thought of this? The officials have come out in Texas and said, this looks like a suicide to them. Where does this go?
I think that is certainly there are some questions that remain in this particular case. And as you mentioned, the autopsy results yesterday that were made public outlined a series of injuries to Ms. Bland's body that the officials who described the autopsy report said are consistent with suicide. However, I think that what really perhaps is worth noting at this moment while the investigations into this particular case are ongoing is just how many sort of sub-issues within the larger scheme of national focus on race and policing this one case would seem to raise. There are questions about the ways in which Ms. Blaine was quite literally arrested, you know, the reason that she was pulled over, the way that she was physically taken into custody, the exchange between herself and the officer, then what happened once she got to the jail, whether or not her disclosed history of depression and suicide attempts was taken seriously and handled in a way that is consistent with standards or national standards. All of these things in one case really, really, really shine a light on the fact that this is not a set of issues that is going away. And if this is what has happened on a country road in Texas, in a county outside of a major city where people are certainly aware of what is going on and what is in the headlines, it does raise real questions about what is the norm, what happens when people interact with police, in particular, people who are not white in America.
Janelle, I was fascinated by your reporting on the demographics of Waller County outside Houston here. You remind us with your reporting that there is a long history of black presence in this community, but at the same time, there are changing demographics. It's kind of a Ferguson situation where you've got now a white minority that is still politically powerful, maybe feeling embattled. What are the demographics here?
It is an interesting space, I guess, geographically and just in terms of what is happening in Waller County in terms of power dynamics. Waller County is a place, as I said, it's near Houston, Texas, and it has long been the home of a very large historically black university, Prairie View University, which, incidentally, Ms. Bland was actually driving through Waller County in order to begin a new job at Prairie View. It's also the school from which she graduated.
Yep.
And so it is a place that has always had a pretty sizable African-American population, but that is a population that has been either largely confined to the area just around campus and some Waller County natives and a larger white population that has really sort of dominated politics there for decades and decades. And as the population has grown more diverse, there's been an influx of Latino residents and some real efforts to ensure the voting rights of African Americans in Waller County. As recently as 2008, there was an effort to disqualify every student at Prairie View University, or just about every student, from voting in Waller County. And you can imagine what that might do to election results.
All those African American young people, yeah.
And this in 2008, which obviously was an election that drew a historic number of African Americans to the polls. So it is a place where there are ongoing questions and or challenges around race, power, and inclusion. There's no question about that. Of course, what we can't say is what role any of that played precisely in what happened to Sandra Bland on the side of this road.
Waller County now 43% white, nearly 30% Latino, nearly 26% black. Sandra Bland on her way to a job at that historically black university, dead in a jail cell. Suicide, the coroner says. Antonio in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I've watched the video at length. And really, one issue I have is that even before he pulled over Sandra Bland, he had another pullover. I guess it was a speeding incident. And he didn't even give the person a ticket. He gave them a warning ticket and sent them on their merry way. Whereas with Sandra Bland, I mean, he pulled her over for the traffic signal not being turned on. And who knows, he may have even recognized she was out of state and saw the tag.
Yep.
And then everything sped up from there. And not one time when she asked him while she was in handcuffs why she was being arrested, he didn't really tell her. And another question is, she may have committed suicide in jail, but if she was wrongly arrested and put in jail for at fault, does that play into the police department being at fault for her suicide? So is that now murder or anything like that, or maybe manslaughter? I don't know.
For her frustration, if that's what she felt at being picked up in this way, I don't think it's a crime, but it's certainly something anybody could imagine really eating at someone. On the other hand, she said as she came in, we are told that she had thought about suicide before, but boy, this could really set a person off. Antonio, I appreciate your call. Mugume in Salem, Massachusetts. Mugume, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I'm calling about this incident, about this lady, and it seems like every person that has been talking about the topic has really talked about the issue of race in America. And my first question is, if this lady was a white lady, how would she have been treated? I'm speaking about this because of my own experiences. When I moved into this country years ago, I used to look at myself as somebody who's like an outsider. The issues of race were not that much of a problem because I never experienced that when I came into this country at first.
Where did you come from, Mugume? Where did you immigrate from?
I'm immigrant from Uganda.
Got it. Okay.
As years have gone by, I've lived in this country for so many years. I've gone to school here. I used to say maybe if you come in this country, go to school and this and that, all those things, maybe you could put them behind. But I find that even with a college education, that does not really help you at all. Every single time here and there, if when you're driving as a black person, you're always, always, always looking behind. Is there a cop behind? Is there a cop here? Race is a big problem in this country.
Mugume, I've got more callers. I really appreciate your call. I'm sorry that you come to find that reality, but we are seeing it's true. A diploma will not protect you. She was headed to her alma mater to get a job. I want to get one more call, if I may, right here. Shawnee, thank you, Mugume. Shawnee, Oklahoma. Rock, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. As a law enforcement officer for over a decade, I see that she got pulled out of the vehicle, and I thought it was illegal that how she got pulled out because you have to have a be able to articulate why the person is a threat and why you need to pull them out for officer safety. And her cigarette wasn't a threat. I think the officer got a stealing cert, and at that point, it really became a battle of wills that he should not have engaged in.
What do you think about race as a factor here, Rock? You work in law enforcement.
Yeah, as a white police officer, I have dealings with blacks, African Americans all the time, and I typically treat them, anybody like everybody, I treat them all the same, you know? So I can't say what was in his mind and what his prejudice might or might not have been, so I really can't speak to that.
I appreciate your call, though, on the procedure followed or not followed here. I appreciate that very much. Chuck Beattie, what are you thinking on this incident? We're just gnawed at by incident after incident. An incident seems too light a word here.
It does. And by the way, Ms. Bland asked 14 times, why am I being arrested? 14 times. That's almost something out of Kafka, you know, Joseph K. Why am I being tried? No answer. You know, what that would do to any personality who was then, you know, her neglect at the jail is something that you just can't avoid. It's this depraved indifference to human life there, to use that phrase. After she had said twice that she had had either depression or suicidal attempt or whatever it was, and their regulations apparently call for a suicide watch or closer monitoring. They didn't do it. They didn't care. It was just so evident. But, you know, in the officer, Brian Encina, we see something here that we don't talk about much because it's a tough thing to talk about. That is the police personality. There's a literature on this. There are classic papers on this. Police departments try to filter out in their testing authoritarian personalities, personalities who look a lot, awful lot the way this officer did, let me quote from one classic paper. A common thread of inhumanity runs through policemen in almost every city in the land. Some psychologists say this is the character trait that draws them to police work in the first place. And that weeding that kind of person out, that is just vital to having any community confidence that policing is, on the square for everybody.
I mean, we at the same time, we need people who will step up and do it. We all know that personality, I guess, but the racial angle comes in. you get something exponential going on, maybe going on here. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, New York will raise the minimum wage for its fast food restaurant workers to $15 an hour. Alvin Major, 49-year-old cook at KFC in Brooklyn, was at a rally on Wednesday.
This would help me to take care of my kids, send them to the right school, and put food on the table.
NASA says it may have found Earth's closest cousin, the most similar planet found yet to our own. Here's John Jenkins, leader of Kepler data analysis for the Kepler Space Telescope.
Today, the Earth is a little less lonely because there's a new kid on the block who moved in just right next door.
It's a very big planet. Looks a lot like us, kind of in that sweet spot near its star, its sun, if you will, but maybe not right next door. Kepler 452b is 1,400 light years away. And historical novelist E.L. Doctorow, author of Ragtime and much more, died at 84. He talked with NPR last year.
I think really of myself as a national novelist, as I'm an American novelist writing about my country.
We're looking at a week in the news with Janelle Ross of The Washington Post, Nancy Youssef of The Daily Beast, and Jack Beatty. Patrick in New Orleans, you're on the air, Patrick.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that some of this is coming to light, and I really appreciate the comments by your panelists there about the authoritarianism of police officers. You don't have to be black to experience it. I'm a physician. In a busy trauma center, and I've seen it myself. I've experienced it. My colleagues have experienced it, and I think it stems from, in part, that we're not paying these guys enough. You know, you're not going to get the best and the brightest to put on a uniform, stand in line of fire, for under $40,000 plus benefits. You know, I think it draws people who have the intellectual and the emotional maturity to flip burgers that have too much of an ego, and so they're drawn to this field, and you don't have to be black. I think it does primarily manifest white on black because of many factors, but it affects all of us. It really is an endemic problem, I think across the country.
I want to be careful here. I don't want to smear a whole class of people who work and often not particularly well paid, as you say, Patrick, by any means. On the other hand, we've got to be alert to what's going on and going on in total, as you say. I appreciate your call from New Orleans. One more, Raleigh, North Carolina. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I had the experience of driving a rental car with out-of-state tags in Austin, Texas, about a year and a half ago, and I'm a white female, and I was pulled for changing lanes with no turn signal. And so when this happened to Ms. Bland, you know, it struck me personally, but it was interesting to me because I ended up alive and white, and she ends up, unfortunately, dead and black. A very similar experience with totally different outcome.
Do you see a control freak officer, a racial measure here, or both, or neither, Gail?
Well, I don't exactly know because, like mm-hmm. the officer who called in, I certainly can't put mm-hmm. Myself into that officer's mind. But the officer who pulled me was pulling me for something that I really had to think was almost laughable, and yet he wasn't the slightest bit antagonistic. And I don't know if that's racial or not. I mean, it's hard to say, but I certainly think that's possible.
Nancy Youssef, I know it's not your beat, but as a citizen, just watching all this unfold, what's going through your mind?
Well, I have to tell you, as a military correspondent, I watch it, and it reminds me of going back overseas where the soldier or officer presumes that it is a field of battle, you know, that the mm-hmm. confrontation is a presumption that there's going to be confrontation, that's sort of the rules of engagement going in. And that's what really struck me. I watched the video like everyone else and was really shocked because I remember being a young police reporter when dash cams were first put on, and it was designed to protect the officer. And then as it turns out, they're increasingly being used and deployed to educate the public about how one could potentially be bullied or treated as a combatant, if you will, on the streets of their community. And so to me, I watched it with that sort of military eye, and it reminded me of going back overseas where the assumption is that the person you're going to confront is a potential threat rather than as one thinks of police officers as there to serve the community, not think of you as a threat.
General Ross, a field of battle? This was a 28-year-old woman who wasn't picked up for driving erratically or waving guns out the window. I mean, I wonder if the police officer could be that keyed up, or maybe this was an issue of dominance and maintaining dominance.
You know, I think as several of your panelists and callers have said, it is ultimately at this moment impossible for any of us to be inside the mind of that particular yep. officer. But I think that there are some things about this case that I would say, again, in a broad sense, really point to some big questions that perhaps are worthy of some attention. And then based on, I think, the reporting that's been done as these issues have continued to surface and fill the nation's headlines for almost four straight summers now, mm-hmm. I think there are some persistent themes. I think This idea of appropriate or professional behavior is certainly one of them. And there are questions for both police to ask and answer among themselves, but also what are the standards that public agencies are going to require? And for that matter, will officers be perhaps evaluated on the grounds of not just how they treat people, but the amount of or the level of citizen complaint and or potential civil liabilities that are created by the way that they do their work? You know, this is a core question. I think another thing that really does stand out to me about this incident is this is a conversation that we're having in large part because there is a video of this woman's arrest. And I think that early on, when the president and several other elected officials suggested that perhaps one avenue or one potential way to reduce the frequency of some of these incidents might be to really increase the frequency with which interactions with the police are being recorded. And there are, of course, some legitimate questions that have been raised about civil liberties concerns and privacy concerns. But I think that there is also this underlying issue of the sort of trust deficit and our cultural inclination to believe exactly what the officer says about the interaction that later led to a complaint. And even in the Bland case, I think that we've seen how the officer and his superiors described what happened. It has evolved somewhat as we have gained access to this footage and as more information has become available. So I think we do have to, while I would join most of your callers and the panelists in saying that there is no way to know definitively what was going on in the mind of that officer, we do have to face what we do see on that tape. We have to face that we've seen the law enforcement agency stories essentially evolve to match up with what is on that tape. And we do know, you know, that Ms. Bland did, in fact, indicate that she had a history of a previous suicide attempt and a history of depression on at least one intake questionnaire as she was entering the jail. These are things that, you know, we do have to deal in the facts. There are also some pretty clear statistics on the fact that people of color, both African-Americans and Latinos in this country, are disproportionately stopped, disproportionately arrested, disproportionately killed or die in police custody. These are things that we can't ignore. They are facts. We can come to our various conclusions about them, but those are the facts.
I've got to draw a line under that right here, right now, but only for now. I'm sure we will be back to this. I see all the calls stacked up on this, but we've got more to look at. Nancy, take us for just a moment to the Middle East. Israel and Ash Carter, Defense Secretary's visit there, talking about the Iran nuclear deal. Turkey now getting tougher on the Islamic State and opening its air bases to the United States. First, on Israel, here was the U.S. Defense Secretary in Tel Aviv on Tuesday saying friends can disagree,
Friends can disagree about whether it will work, and we'll be watching Iran very closely to see. But there's no disagreement about the ultimate objective. We cannot let Iran have a nuclear weapon.
Okay, Nancy Yusuf, friends, I guess, do disagree here. Certainly the White House and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, disagree very sharply on the Iran nuclear deal. But does the relationship work if they disagree at this depth?
Well, they sure did disagree. The Prime Minister of Israel all but snubbed the Secretary of Defense in front of the cameras, sort of forcibly shook his hand and scoffed off, if you will, when they appeared before the cameras. The Israelis are very aggressive and speaking out against this deal. What was interesting is that when he left Israel, the Secretary then went to Saudi Arabia and said that the Saudis were in support of the deal, something they had never said publicly. And you could start to see that former or current friends of the United States trying to navigate this world, the Israelis being much more aggressive, the Saudis taking a much more passive approach, if you will, saying nothing directly out of fear of upsetting the Americans, out of fear of upsetting the Iranians with this what they see as a potential shift in regional balances. And so I think what the Secretary's trip exposed is how what are supposed to be the U.S.'s closest allies reacting so very differently to the deal. One group very aggressively and assertively coming out against the deal, and the other trying to passively maneuver through these new waters.
And this, Nancy, Turkey now aggressively going after the Islamic State and opening air bases, I guess, to the United States. Is this the signal that U.S. air power now rains down on the Islamic State and the counteroffensive begins? What's going on here?
Well, that was something that the United States had been trying to get for months because it gives them a lot more maneuverability to
100 miles from ISIS rather than 1,000 miles or more.
That's exactly right. And this was something they'd been aggressively pushing for. Practically speaking, it's a big win for the United States. And symbolically, it's one to show that the Turks are willing to support the campaign against the Islamic State this directly. And so this was something that the United States had been pushing for literally for months to signal to the region that Turkey was going to overtly support despite opposition within that country, and that they would now have more maneuverability. Remember that the United States has a limited supply of drones and other assets, and so to be able to use those 100 miles away really opens up a lot of options in terms of using that air power to confront the Islamic State.
Changing chemistry and options in the Middle East. Let's bring it back home to politics. We gave it to Trump at the top, but it was Ohio Governor John Kasich announcing his candidacy for the Republican nomination on Tuesday. Here's a speech saying he would learn what he usually learned in Ohio to inform his presidency.
I'm going to take what we've learned here in the heartland, that band of brothers and sisters that I work with every day, and we are going to take the lessons of the heartland and straighten out Washington, D.C., and fix our country.
There you go. John Kasich and Scott Walker will be with us here on Monday with On Point. Jack Beatty, what do you see in this candidacy?
Well, this is, for one thing, I see Ohio. No Republican has ever won the presidency without carrying Ohio. Ohio is now on the board. You put Ohio together with Florida, and there are two candidates from Florida, and you subtract 47 electoral votes from the Obama 2012 total. That brings you within, well, Virginia range of a Republican victory. I think his entry into the race can't be overstated. Not that he's going to win, but that if he can be persuaded to be a vice presidential candidate, it's going to be extremely powerful ticket there. He carried practically every county in the state when he ran for re-election, and he's an interesting man. He had a terrible experience as a young man. He lost both parents and an auto accident. He was grown, but it was a crushing thing. And he said, "The Lord has dropped something on my head about an intense sense of compassion." That really changed him. That led him to expand Medicaid for over 450,000 people in Ohio, very unpopular with Republicans. And he was taken to task for that by the wife of a fundraiser. I think it was at a Koch brothers fundraiser, and he said, she said, why did you say God wanted you to do it? He said, I don't know about you, lady, pointing at her, but when I get to the pearly gates, I'm going to have to answer for what I've done for the poor. And that shows the other side of his personality, a hair-trigger temper, according even to John McCain. So he's a very interesting man with this. He's for immigration reform, not popular with Republicans. He's for Common Core.
We'll have him right here on Monday. Scott Walker as well. Should be a very interesting conversation. Jack, our time grows short, but I want to touch on this Planned Parenthood conversation, this sting video, a couple of videos out, where you've got this fake, phonied-up company that's looking to buy fetal tissue with Planned Parenthood's help. This is getting lots of attention in the anti-abortion world, a lot of calls to shut down funding for Planned Parenthood. Now Planned Parenthood says, look, this goes for important research, and there's nothing illegal or wrong here. What about this, Jack?
That is is the fact. There was nothing illegal or wrong in that video. Planned Parenthood, in fact, the people edited out of the video the statement by the doctor, and I think there were several, that Planned Parenthood does not sell fetal body parts. It does not sell them. It only
they
accepts,
charge for delivery or yes, $30, $100, whatever
it is. $30 or $100 per specimen, something like that.
Still, this is queasy territory.
Queasy territory, and her people are making much of the dispassion, to call it that, perhaps crudeness, with which the doctor talked about moving organs around and looking for things. But frankly, that is how anybody who has to perform what we would think of as dehumanizing work comes to talk about it. You can't look at it in any other terms, and this is a campaign of deception straight out against Planned Parenthood, which does valuable work every day.
Still, it is hot. Arthur Kaplan, bioethicist at New York University, has described fetal tissue research as the ticking time bomb of medical ethics, and I am sure that we have not heard the last of that story. Wow, crowded week of news. I want to thank all three of you for being with us to look at it. Nancy Youssef with the Daily Beast, senior national security correspondent there. Nancy, it's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Janelle Ross, reporter for The Washington Post. You're terrific, Janelle. Please come back. Thank you for joining us, Janelle.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always. Have a good weekend. Savor the summer, sir, while we can.
Thank you.
Listeners, same to you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.